It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll take a look at why Wisconsinites are so good at volunteering and how you can get involved at an organization near you.
First, the print edition of the latest issue of Charlie Hebdo hit newsstands today. The satirical French magazine isn't normally the subject of a lot of American media attention, but after the mass shooting at the paper's Paris office last week that killed 12, all eyes are now on Charlie and where they go from here.
Well, the latest issue doesn't skip a beat. Its now famous cover features another controversial depiction of the Prophet Muhammad, which has news organizations facing a tough question. Should they reprint the cartoon? The New York Times decided not to, along with other news outlets. That's leading to a good deal of criticism. But how do news organizations make decisions like this on big ethical questions, and where's the line drawn between news value and content that could be offensive?
Here with us now to discuss these questions is Martha Steffens. She's a professor at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. Martha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
So for those who haven't seen it, can you describe the latest Charlie Hebdo cover?
Well, it is a bright green, and there is the Prophet Muhammad on the cover, saying all is there's behind him. It says all is forgiven in French, and he's holding the sign "Je suis Charlie," so I am Charlie.
So the depiction
it's really not quite as offensive as some of his previous cartoons. So
right, but there's always the issue that for many Muslims, any depiction of
any
of the
depiction
prophet.
Of the prophet, right? Mm-hmm.
So before this came out, even news organizations here in the United States were wrangling with the question, you know, of what prior controversial Charlie Hebdo cartoons they could publish. Is this just extending that discussion a little further?
It is. Frankly, American publications always err on the side of caution. One of the things that we as Americans kind of embrace is the fact that we respect other cultures and that, you know, just like we don't do blackface, just like we don't do other things that might be disrespectful, particularly to minority groups, we err on the side of not doing certain kinds of things, particularly cartoons, which are characterizations that often exaggerate. So, American publications, you know, whether it be a gory photograph or other kinds of things that might not pass what we used to call the breakfast test, you know, could you face this in the morning? You know, we do err on the side of not publishing those things. And I'm a former newspaper editor, so I used to wrestle with these issues.
Now, the New York Times, their decision was to not publish this cover in particular and the previous cartoons. Their public editor said, you know, that may have been a bad call. There's news value. You're doing a disservice to readers by not printing it, by not letting them see what it is that the articles and everybody is talking about.
Well, it's not really difficult to find. News reports sort of showed it in the distance. I know on the BBC, which I've been watching here, I'm still in Europe. You could kind of see the cover. It's not difficult for anyone who wants to find the cover to be able to Google it. So the images are everywhere.
Well, on NPR's website, our colleagues at NPR, there's an image over an article that shows the cover, not quite. It shows the top half of the cover and obscures the rest of it. I, of course, went right down to the comments section, and a lot of people, NPR listeners, calling that decision cowardly. Is it cowardly for a media outlet to not run the image of this magazine cover?
Well, everybody has to understand their own audience, and every editorial decision must be made by the people who regularly deal with that audience. So if your supervisors, editors at NPR felt that it would offend some of your listeners and viewers, then, of course, they might decide to not publish that. But, again, it always is a very individualized, community-based decision, whether that community is large or small.
And New York Times, among others, cited safety concerns. If they publish these images, it could put, say, their foreign correspondents in the Middle East at risk, might make them targets of retaliation.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, that's particularly the case. It's clearly, I don't know if you had a chance to see the Danish newspaper editor who has lived under threats for years after their Danish publication published some cartoons of Muhammad years ago. You know, they decided not to run it, and they were particularly brave in years past. But they said, you know, for them, violence, you know, spoke a large message, and they didn't really feel that they should put themselves at risk.
Now, these are cartoons that if someone had submitted them to the New York Times, I don't want to keep picking on them, but any paper in the United States, any major paper, to their editorial page, they wouldn't have printed them, presumably.
Many of them were profane and kind of not the thing that we're used to in the United States. The United States seems to have a more subtle idea of parody. Europe likes to have much more biting satire. Americans are much more used more parody rather than really angry kinds of passionate messages, if you will. We're more into Saturday Night Live and the kind of gentle poking fun at institutions rather than, you know, the really sharp messages that you often will see in some other publications. Even in the Middle East, you'll see some very sharp cartoons and characterizations.
Now, I've seen some media outlets around the world making a point of running the most controversial cartoons and of showing the newest cover that we've been talking about as a way of showing solidarity with the satirists who died in that attack last week. Is that a common response, do you think, in the journalistic world?
I don't know that it's common. Kum Hurriyet, which is called the Republic in Turkey, did do that. They did create a four-page supplement that they were going to put in the latest editions of that newspaper based out of Istanbul. It's a nationwide newspaper in Turkey. It's the title is called the Republic in English, and it's a 90-year-old newspaper, so it's not a poke-in-your-eye kind of newspaper, and they were going to do that. And before they had a chance to publish, their offices were raided by Turkish officials who felt that that was going to be very offensive to the Muslim population there.
Do we have other precedents that inform this discussion, apart from the Danish cartoon that you talked about a few moments ago?
Well, certainly cartooning is a very strong practice in the Middle East among the Arab cultures. I edited a publication for the International Press Institute 2 years ago, which kind of looked at cartooning throughout the Middle East, but particularly in the Sinai Peninsula. And I know a lot of cartoonists, because of the way they like to poke fun at, or not poke fun, but make their point through these cartoons, really felt that they were being particularly brave by using this particular format to make their point. So, you know, I think you have to understand that cartooning in the United States just doesn't have quite the same political edge that it does in other parts of the world.
We're talking with Martha Steffens about the latest edition of Charlie Hebdo, the French satire weekly, the new cover, again, showing the Prophet Muhammad on it, and the decision by some media outlets here in the United States to run or to not run photos of that cover. And we'd like to hear what you think of all this.
Well, what do you think? Do you think news organizations should be publishing the controversial cover of Charlie Hebdo, which depicts a tearful Prophet Muhammad? Do we have a right to see it? Does it advance the journalistic cause, or are there overweighing ethical issues? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with journalism professor Martha Steffens about some of the ethical questions that American media outlets are grappling with when it comes to the new Charlie Hebdo cover. It shows another depiction of the Prophet Muhammad, not particularly offensive maybe to Western eyes, but offensive maybe to Muslims around the world. The decision to reprint it, to show a photo of it or not, and different media outlets are going different ways with their answers. What's your answer? What do you think? How should American media tackle this? Call now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Ray on the line in Milwaukee. Ray, hi.
Hi. I'm somebody who I consider myself to be left of the average left-winger here in America. But this whole controversy strikes me as rather just kind of stupid in a way. I, as a cartoonist, maybe would have no trouble drawing the cartoon and maybe risking my own life. But this cartoonist, you know, the place was firebombed a few years ago. So knowing the controversy, why keep poking the hornet's nest? And if it was a Nazi paper and they were Nazis that had been shot, I'm sure you wouldn't see this standing behind freedom of press. It's just, it happens to be because for whatever reason we have determined, Muslims are less than human beings, so let's just mock everything we can about them. And during this time of war, couldn't we just chill out on this, drawing the prophet? Is it that important to these cartoonists? Can't they get their ideas across in a more respectful way that doesn't also put the public at risk? I mean, this just seems insane. Why?
Ray, thanks a lot for the call. Martha is saying, in effect, just because we can publish these images, these cartoons, critical, mocking the prophet Muhammad, doesn't mean we should.
Well, certainly that's everybody's choice. And you know, if when I was a newspaper editor, and, you know, I would think, I would agree that certainly there are other ways to make your point. Criticize the action that an individual takes or a group takes, but don't kind of stereotype an entire religion. Or an entire, you know, way of life. And, you know, and that's, you know, perhaps some of the conversation here. So I certainly understand this listener's point.
But the attacks of last week, in a way, I think in many minds, have turned these images that a lot of people might have thought were a bad idea or not cared much about one way or the other into icons, representations of free speech rights. Do they deserve that elevation since the attacks last week?
Well, I think we need to look at a broader point. What they're saying is everybody has a right under particular countries' laws to say something, even though it might be offensive. And as long as it doesn't violate the hate speech laws in France, then, you know, they have the right to say it. And it certainly doesn't elevate it to the right to the point of killing someone just for saying something. And then, of course, you have the point of the believers who say that, you know, any depiction of their prophet, is a insult to them. So is an insult worth somebody's life? That's the question.
Ray, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Bill with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Oh, hi. Well, I just wanted to say that I think this is really more a question of freedom of religion. And freedom of religion includes the right to be critical of other people's religion in any way that you might see fit. And I really think that's what the American Revolution was about. And I just really think it's an act of cowardice on the part of the New York Times and many others not to publish the cartoon.
Bill, thanks for the call. And Bill, echoing what a lot of people critical of the New York Times and other outlets have said, that this is cowardice. In a way, it's an act of surrender, giving into the intimidation of the attackers last week, Martha.
Well, I think you could look at it a couple of different ways. One is, did we found this nation based on respect to allow people to practice their own religions in the way they choose? Or did we found this country allowing people to criticize other religions? So it kind of depends on how you want to look at where we cross the line. And, of course, that is always what we're talking about in freedom of speech. You know, we are free to say and feel our ideas until it gets to the point where it foments hatred. And I think that's a great discussion to have. And, you know, I'm glad this listener called and once again kind of talks about that point of view. So that's what makes this a democracy, is that we are really airing kind of that edge where, we start to talk about our rights as it impinges upon other people's rights.
Having worked at newspapers, Martha, did you have these issues where you had to weigh the news value of an article or image versus the potential for causing offense to your readership?
Oh, all the time. I was editor during the time when there was the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and a lot of that testimony in the impeachment of President Clinton was pretty you know, pretty graphic and pretty dicey. And so, you know, you always are considering, you know, the average reader and the sensibility of your community and whether or not you want to have that on the front page. And so quite a lot of newspapers take the kind of step that the New York Times did, which is they you could actually, I believe how it worked was you could click on a link and see the cover. It just wasn't part of, it just wasn't printed in the newspaper, and it wasn't shown on their website. But you could certainly find it through a link. I don't know. I'm not here in the United States. I was in Paris at the time of the attacks with a group of students, and I'm still here in Europe now. So I didn't get to actually see the New York Times itself. But a lot of newspapers choose to take a cautioned approach. So you don't print the objectionable image on page one, but you might print it inside and inform readers that there might be a graphic image. So I think that you see a lot of people warn the public that, you know, and not surprise them with something that might be objectionable.
Go back to our callers now with Nick in Madison. Nick, hi.
Hello there. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just want to comment on something that the host has already kind of alluded to, but since the attack, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, freedom of speech and people rallying around that. And that's wonderful. But along with freedom of speech, I'm just a big believer, and you have to have some respect for what's actually coming out of your mouth and who you're poking fun at. And I hope that doesn't get lost in the rally behind freedom of speech, because you do have to always have an air of respect for, you know, your fellow citizen. And, you know, people that may disagree with you, you have to always put respect in that equation. So that's what I wanted to say.
Nick, thanks a lot for that call. I'm guessing a lot of people in the mainstream journalism world would agree with that point, Martha. But do different standards apply to satire? Should nothing be sacred to a satirical outlet like Charlie Hebdo?
I think that even a lot of the comedians find that sometimes, you know, they feel that they've crossed the line. You know, you see that everywhere when you have parody or satire, that sometimes, you know, it's not going to be well received, that it's too soon or too early or too raw or perhaps too pointed. So, yes, of course, comedy at times can cross the line.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Mike now in Green Bay. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to give my vote of confidence to Charlie Hebdo for reprinting that. And I think the caller, Bill, was right about the American press being fearful. But I think they've been guilty of that for decades. I think that when you're going to start killing people over their opinion, you know, how offensive is a picture, really?
Mike, thanks a lot for the call and sharing your thoughts. Martha, in our last couple of minutes, you are there in Europe. You mentioned you were in Paris when the attacks happened, still in Europe. What kind of conversations are you seeing? What kind of reactions are you seeing when it comes to the media and these images in the satirical weekly?
Well, certainly a lot of other publications are not running them. You know, largely because there's been threats. I'm here in Belgium, and you know, there's been some issues here in Belgium. There's been some raids. There's been some concerns. In fact, one of the terror group members apparently bought their weapons here in Belgium. So, you know, Belgium's on high alert. A lot of the publications are here. One of the things that's difficult for Americans to understand is the Muslim community in Europe is quite large. It's about 10 to 15% of the population, which is far larger than in the United States. They're often are poor. They're discriminated against. So there's a lot of different layers to the Muslim relationship with, you know, with Europeans than in the United States. You know, there are some concerns. In fact, I'm here in Belgium, a country where there are several hundred Flemish young men who are originally Muslim
who are who gone to Syria to become freedom fighters. So there's a real fear here in Europe of what we call homegrown terrorists, which of course the Koichi brothers were in Paris. They were basically homegrown terrorists. And so I think that's a lot different than Americans might understand, that the fear is palpable.
Well, Martha, thanks for joining us and staying up late on European time.
Yes, thank you.
That was Martha Steffen. She is a professor at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in just a few moments, we'll take a look at volunteerism in Wisconsin and how to get involved.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Snow and cold trigger warm memories for Crystal Chan. Now living in Chicago, she recalls what winter meant during a Wisconsin childhood and how she tries to recapture that now.
Something magical happens when I go home to Wisconsin in the winter. The congestion of Chicago melts away, and the cool, calm, undulating land comes into focus, covered in snow, and the earth stretches out freely from horizon to glowing horizon. When I was a child, we would drive from Oshkosh to Wausau to visit my grandmother. She had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's back in the 80s and didn't pass away until a couple years ago, so almost all my life, when we drive up north in the winter, the snow would cover the rows upon rows of corn, and then the rocks, and then the bushes. Everything would disappear under the ubiquitous blanket of white, not unlike how Alzheimer's was covering up my grandmother. Sometimes the snow would melt and the stubble of corn would appear, and sometimes my grandmother would remember my name. But then sometimes she wouldn't, and the snow would cover everything all over again. My mom would take us to the local sledding hill in town. It was called Garbage Hill because it was the site of the old city dump, now covered over with dirt and grass. I never questioned the name as a child, but as an adult, I wonder why you would ever name anything garbage and expect people to be attracted to it. Yet, that's precisely what it was called. It was the highest thing for miles around, and that's where the young discovered their love for speed. In a way, a part of me is kind of resentful for naming something so fun Garbage Hill. But then another part of me respects the fact that even garbage can be transformed, and that there is an inherent strength in naming things exactly as they are. In parking lots in Wisconsin, the snowplows can push up mountains of snow that are monstrous and glistening white. One day, my dad, who is usually overly cautious, had the brazen idea to ram the car with the four of us in it through one of the smaller snowbanks in a Shopko parking lot. Even my mom went along with the idea. We all had this vision of our car blasting through the snowbank like a rocket, sending snow flying in all directions. My dad hit the accelerator, and we rammed into that snowbank, and our seatbelts locked as the car slammed and stopped dead at the bank's edge, the snow solid and heavy like a brick wall and laughing at us, we who tried to defy the gods. Dad swore something bad. We all rubbed our necks and then got out to see the damage. Of course, we needed to push the car out of the snowbank so we could drive home, the four of us humble and silent. Snow in Chicago doesn't last long. Flakes of snow often melt upon contact, and if it does stick around, it turns black within hours. The one exception is the snow along Lake Michigan, and I slip on my snowshoes and go out there whenever I can. But for nearly everyone else, snow is messy and sloppy and dirty. Maybe that's why, when I tell people that winter is my favorite season, they look at me like I'm an alien. And maybe they're right. Maybe the heart is not really one big muscle, but more a jigsaw puzzle. And this piece, this winter piece of mine, fits only with Wisconsin, my home.
Crystal Chan is a storyteller, writer, and the author of Bird. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik and is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org or look for Wisconsin Life on Facebook.
Say what you will about Wisconsinites, and keep it good stuff. And one of those good things you could say, having a lack of generosity doesn't happen. We tend to be really good when it comes to pitching in, helping out, and giving up our time, volunteering, even when no one asks us to.
A recent report from the Corporation for National and Community Service backs this up. It found that Wisconsin ranked 5th in the nation for the percentage of residents who volunteered in 2013. That came out to more than 1.6 million service hours at a value of more than $3.7 billion.
If you're a volunteer, you know the good feelings that come from it. But if you haven't taken the volunteer plunge, our next guest has some advice on how to get started and how to pick an organization or a cause that's right for you.
Joining us now is Julia Drobeck. She's the Executive Director of the Volunteer Center of East Central Wisconsin. Julia, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Well, looking at that report from the Corporation for National and Community Service, they found Wisconsin one of the top states in the nation for volunteering. What do you think it is about Wisconsinites that they're so generous with their time?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to that generation of, you know, we came from that farming community, and when a farmer needed help and their neighbors would come to help them out with whatever task it was, and I think it just kind of carried on from one generation to another. When we see someone in need and someone asks us for help, we're right there to help them out.
Well, we did pretty good in this report. Do you think, though, there's still room for us to improve here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think there's always room. So the report basically said one out of three people are volunteering, so that means two out of three of us aren't. So we can kind of work on those other folks that aren't volunteering, and as we're out volunteering, we can invite someone to come with us and experience volunteering as well.
So who came in ahead of us?
Ahead of us, Minnesota. We got to beat Minnesota.
Minnesota? What?
Yeah. You know, Utah is always number one, so that's always the top one. And the other ones, number two was Idaho, and Minnesota is third. Kansas is fourth. Wisconsin was fifth. Nebraska is sixth. Hmm. So a lot of other Midwestern states. So it goes back to that Midwestern, you know, how we're raised. It does carry through our adult life and giving back to our communities.
So can you tell us some about the benefits of volunteering for the community at large and for the person doing the volunteering?
Well, so many things that even in our daily lives, we come into contact with people that are probably volunteering at nonprofit agencies that we might be, you know, helping or getting services from. It's those community agencies like the food bank, the food programs, hospice programs, transportation programs, even the hospitals operate with volunteers. If we didn't have those volunteers within those structures, you know, a lot of those places, that's what they depend on as their workforce. As volunteers, we receive that benefit of, you know, really knowing that we're doing something to help someone else out, and we get that wonderful joy of giving back.
Well, let's say someone's not currently a volunteer, but they're ready to take that jump and start helping out. What are some of the first things that we need to think about?
Well, the first thing that we usually ask people is, how much time do you have? And what is your passion? And what skill do you have that you want to share? Do you want to volunteer with other people? Do you want to volunteer by yourself? What skill do you want to learn? Maybe it's more about learning something new about the community and meeting new people. So it's asking all those questions. Do you want to volunteer with your family? Do you want to volunteer with friends? And involve them in your volunteering as well.
Do a lot of organizations that work with volunteers really train them in, bring them up to speed on what they need to do and how everything works?
Yes. I think Wisconsin's very good at having a lot of strong nonprofits that encourage and invite people to come into their agencies, but also give them that orientation and training and how they can help them get their agencies even better. And its statistics also show that as volunteers come into organizations, those volunteers become donors, and then it just kind of creates that whole cycle.
I remember back when, I think it was Barack Obama was running for president the first time, he had a push for people to volunteer to give back. Do you see that still being carried on, that national message to volunteer on a bigger than a state level?
Yeah, AmeriCorps is very large in the state, and as well as Senior Corps programs. And the AmeriCorps programs, many of the nonprofits in Wisconsin have AmeriCorps members serving within those agencies. And for ourselves at our volunteer center, we have a senior core program. We have RSVP, which is the citizens 55 years and older that are volunteering in the community. And our folks are volunteering out there within 100 different agencies in our area.
Now, do a lot of people take their occupational skills and use them in volunteering, you know, a carpenter doing woodwork for an organization or a graphic designer designing the new web page, that kind of thing?
Yes, and that's that, you know, sitting down and what skill do you have that you can share, and then we work with them to, like, listen to the different agencies that we're working with, you know, what do they need on that flip side, you know, Habitat for Humanity, needing those carpenters, needing those electricians, you know, to build that person's home. So whatever that volunteer has to offer, we can find them a volunteer opportunity.
Should you try to pick an organization that fits your skill set, or is it kind of fun to mix it up and try some new things and learn some new skills?
I think it's up to that individual and that person, and it is making that right fit at that right time. And sometimes we always tell people to go and check out the organization, because every organization, be it, you know, in your paid life or your volunteer life, each organization has its own personality, and maybe your personality of what you're looking for isn't quite the right fit. And so it's kind of looking and finding that fit as well for yourself, so you're more likely to do it long term if you find that fit and it's beneficial to the volunteer as well as the agency.
We're talking with Julia Drobeck about the benefits of volunteering. A recent report named Wisconsin as the fifth best state in the nation when it comes to the rate of volunteerism. Still room to grow, though. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234.
And volunteers, we'd love to hear from you. Where do you volunteer your time, and what do you get out of it? What do you give back and feel that you're getting in return? If you're not a volunteer, what could convince you to become one? Call us at 800-642-1234.
We're talking with Julia Drobeck. She's the executive director of the Volunteer Center of East Central Wisconsin, talking about the benefits of volunteering. We're pretty good volunteers here in Wisconsin, it turns out. Talking about how to get involved, maybe with an organization near you. You can join in, share your experience as a volunteer, or maybe tell us about your organization that depends on volunteers and the work they do. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We go to our callers now. We've got Paul joining us from Two Rivers. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Hi, Julia. This is Paul Vitas.
Hello, Paul. I thought that was you.
Yeah, good. I just wanted you to talk just a little bit about how important it is for high school students to volunteer, especially as they're doing their career exploration and finding out about the world of work.
Okay, good point, Paul. And what do you think about that, Julia, getting young people involved?
That is exactly how I think our rates in Wisconsin has grown, because our young people are seeing the benefits of volunteering, and it's one way to also try out a career path. It's one way to get connected in our community, and as we know, many colleges also require students to have that on their applications as they get into colleges. So I think anytime we get young people to volunteer and to give it a try is a wonderful thing.
Paul, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Sarah now in La Crosse. Sarah, hi.
Hi, I am calling. I recently got a position for a grant in La Crosse, and it's the Second Chance Act. So my job requires me to gather about 50 to 75 volunteers for the program. They're working with inmates, kind of helping them transition back into society. And the hardest part I'm finding is trying to get people that are willing to make a six-month commitment. And I was just wondering if you had any advice on making a longer commitment of volunteering seem worthy to people.
Interesting, Sarah. Thanks. Julia, how do you sell that, getting people to commit and volunteer for a long period of time?
I think that's always the struggle for many nonprofits, is getting people to sign up for that long term. Sometimes it's just presenting that information to the volunteer of what is so critical about that program, and what if those volunteers don't come forward and serve that time for that 6 months, what could maybe happen to the program, the community, and really focusing on the benefits of what the community will gain by those volunteers being there, you know, reducing the crime rate, helping these folks get back into society and being a contributing members to our society. It's each program needs to really kind of look at, you know, how can we get that information out to give people that positive choice to say yes.
Well, Sarah, thanks a lot for that. Next, we go to Al in Racine. Hi, Al.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good evening. Well, I represent the Volunteer Center of Racine County, and we have over 3,000 volunteers registered with about 250 agencies that use us to volunteer. And to dovetail on that issue on the value of volunteering in the job search, we do once a month we do a program at the Workforce Development Center, stressing indeed the ability to network. Once you, regardless of what group you're in, oftentimes that group will look out for you. And when there's a job in that organization that you're volunteering in, they have a little resume as well. And also, it was mentioned, it's really super in Racine here. St. Catherine's High School now has mandatory community service for graduation, and it's wonderful because we got the kids calling us now, which is great. And another service we provide here is offering community service to those that are referred by the courts. And in lieu of a fine, the judges send them here. And then we try to get them to see the value of service learning. And that's another thing. But we're really plugged into volunteerism here. I'm sorry if I'm not directly with the topic you're with, but a friend of mine here said, hey, get on the phone and talk to you guys, because we're real active in Racine and volunteerism. Martin Luther King Day is coming up on Monday, so we'll be involved in 300 kids through the school district, getting them out in the community.
Well, terrific. Thank you, Al, for telling us about what you've got going on in Racine. A lot of opportunities there to volunteer. Hub like that. Now, Julia, is that a good place to begin, a place that, that coordinates from a big level like that?
Correct. And actually, Al beat me, too. That Al is part of the Volunteer Center Network, and in the state of Wisconsin, we have about 22 different volunteer centers across the state that are a great place if people don't know where to go to find out what's happening in their community. And we will sit down with you one-on-one. You can go to our websites. You can check out what is listed on the website that way, so you can find volunteering however you want it as the individual. And in the state of Wisconsin, we have a program called Volunteer Wisconsin, and there is a contact in each and every 72 counties in Wisconsin where you can kind of get started if there isn't a volunteer center located in those counties. And the website that people can go to, and the volunteer centers are also on this website as well, is volunteerwisconsin.org.
Al, thanks for the call. We'll go to Nick in Green Bay now. Nick, hi.
Hi. Good evening, everyone. One thing I just wanted to say, just with my own experience in volunteering, recently at my regular daytime job, we actually began getting offered what was called a volunteering time off, basically where we could get paid for 4 hours to go out and work with various volunteer organizations.
So what did you go and volunteer with, Nick?
Well, I'm going to be working with the, going to try and get some time with the Humane Society. I've always enjoyed that. When I was in high school, I worked with the Brown County Humane Society outside of Millsville, Wisconsin. And I'd like to start doing that with the Clark County Humane Society as well.
Nick, thanks a lot. Julie, is that common where businesses give you time off to go out and volunteer?
Yes, there are companies in the state of Wisconsin that do that. And in many of the regions where there's a volunteer center, we actually have what we call workplace volunteer councils, where we actually get together with those folks within those businesses that encourage their employees to volunteer, and we help them find those opportunities and get those employees connected to team-building projects or ongoing volunteer projects within their communities.
Well, thank you to Nick for that. One more call here from Gabby in Appleton. Hi, Gabby.
Hi there.
What did you want to share?
Well, I just wanted to say I went back to college a little bit later in life for a degree in human services. As part of that, we were required to do 400 hours of internship work with no pay associated. At first, I was kind of put off by that, being a working mother going back to school. But I will tell you that I now work for that organization, Elizabeth Ministry, and it is absolutely wonderful. Now my whole family volunteers multiple times a year. I've got an extended family to volunteer, you know, and I got my career out of it.
Great. Well, terrific. Thank you for sharing that, Gabby. Gabby found her vocation, her job, not just started as a volunteer opportunity, but now she works for the place she volunteered. Is that typical, Julia, that people find new career options, maybe that they began as volunteers?
The Corporation for National Community Service also did a report last year and found that people that volunteer, 27% of them found paid employment through their volunteering experiences. So it really does pay to volunteer.
That's a pretty big number, almost a third of people.
It is.
We heard from Kristen on Facebook who writes, volunteering is the best way to meet new people. When I moved to a new town, Green Bay, I started working with the Green Bay Garden Blitz, found a wonderful, supportive, and generous group of individuals, especially in the winter when I feel cranky from being cooped up inside. Planning that spring gardening project can really lift my spirits. So a great way to meet people and get connected with your community too, Julia.
Correct. And we just actually had a call from one of the volunteers that we placed with the transportation program that did his first driving with a client this week, and he found it so rewarding. And he said, my wife just bought me a GPS, so I'll be able to find all the addresses when I go and pick up the people for the transportation and the driving program. So it's really finding that right fit really benefits everybody.
You're talking about finding the right fit, Julia. Is there any advice you have for people to find that right fit? Because there are occasions that happen. Someone volunteers and that organization may not be the right fit for them, but it doesn't mean that volunteering as a whole should be thrown out. How do you pick someone who is in line with what you want to do?
I think that that's where, you know, our uniqueness as a volunteer center, people can come in and look at some of the agencies and what the agency has listed as their volunteer needs. A lot of times people will be reading over the paragraphs and like, wow, I had no idea that that was a volunteer job, that I could do that as a volunteer. I'd like to give that a try. And once again, it's giving it a try. You never know until you do it.
And Julia, before we let you go, do you ever have a situation there where you just have too darn many volunteers, you have to start turning people away?
There's never such a thing. We can always find a place for them, and that's what, you know, a volunteer center, we work with over 100 different agencies just in our community, so we can find a place for you.
Julia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Julia Drobeck. She is Executive Director of the Volunteer Center of East Central Wisconsin. You can keep this conversation going. Share your experience as a volunteer or somebody who relies on volunteers. Just head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us your story.